ne prence.
O ciel!
Troppo taresti, arti, e non dubbia fama di mille eroi che imprese il tuo ritorno prevenga. Di regnare, se l'arte a prender vuoi, ora incomincio a renderti del miseri il sostegno del padre di te stesso, onor più degno.
And on that final chord, that becomes the first chord of the following trio, which is where we cut it off. Now, we will not listen to this following trio. I'll read through it. It's a long goodbye. It's very, very beautiful, but we're limited by our time together. Let's understand the important point now, because it should be forming in all our minds. Where's the predictable pattern of recitative aria, that is opera seria? It sure is not here. Whatever Mozart's doing, it's going against the grain, and as a result, we have a tremendous flexibility of different orchestral forces, different kinds of numbers, one piling on the other. A trio is very rare in opera seria. They're hard to write. They take time to write. They're hard to balance. It's not the kind of music we are accustomed to hearing in this more formulaic procedure. But Mozart does it because, my friends, he can. Itamante says, before leaving, allow me, O God, to place a kiss on the paternal hand. And Electra says to Idomeneo, let my lips express in parting the gratitude with which my heart is filled. Farewell, noble king. And Idomeneo, maintaining this kind of formal behavior, go, good luck be with you. This is your destiny, my son. Fulfill our wishes, O heavens. Electra says, how great are my hopes. And Itamante, I go, but my heart remains here. Cruel destiny. O Ilia, O father, O departure. And then Idamante, Idomeneo, and Electra say together, O gods, what will happen? And that merges seamlessly into what happens next, which is the final moment of this second act. Suddenly and unexpectedly, allegro con brio, the music becomes stormy to indicate the emotions being felt and to presage what's about to come. And we will pick up from the very end of the trio. This is more tempest music, like what we heard in that Vivaldi aria a lecture ago. Tempest music, that is, a storm in nature as a metaphor for an emotional storm in the hearts of people. They all sing together, let this turbulence cease, heaven's compassion will lend its hand. And as they're about to embark on the boat, a storm suddenly springs upon them out of nowhere. Orchestral introduction, all hell breaks loose. Demonic rushing strings alternate with pulsing chords. We hear the piccolo screaming above our heads. Oh, this is not just a storm, my friends. It's a cataclysm. Quietly trembling strings are followed by an explosive entry by the chorus, who sings, what new terror is this? What harsh roaring? The anger of the gods has made the sea violent. Neptune, have pity. The ferocious orchestral storm, wide dynamic ranges, and huge chords fill the chorus with dreadful fear and energy. The storm increases. We hear the sea rising in ever higher melodic ideas, thunder and lightning, and then a terrible monster appears from out of the sea. It is Neptune's emissary, and the chorus recognizes its appearance as a punishment intended for one or all of them. They don't know who. Only Idomeneo knows why this sea creature is there. And so the chorus sings fearfully, what hatred, what anger Neptune shows us. What is our fault that the heavens become angry? Who is the guilty one? Dramatically and repeatedly, the chorus asks, who is the guilty one? That merges immediately into a recitative, but now accompanied by the full orchestra. No time to go back to just the harpsichord. And it's Idomeneo, and he knows it's him, and he says, you are after me, O cruel God, the guilty one. I alone sinned. Punish me only, and let your anger fall on me. Let my death appease you. But if you insist on having a victim for my failing, I cannot give you an innocent one. You are unjust if you want him. You have no claim upon him. And for the first time in this opera, Idomeneo sounds powerful and heroic and utterly kingly. Finally, the wimpiness and fear that's characterized him to this point leaves, and he is once again a powerful monarch. I would tell you that this passage, this accompanied recitative, was originally intended by Varesco, the librettist, to be an aria. And Mozart said, no way, we need a recitative there. Aria would have stopped the action. Aria would have stopped the real-time continuity and forced a moment of reflection and repose. Mozart said, no way. Now we do need action. We do need real-time. We do need forward-moving music. It must be recitative. And so recitative it is. The orchestral storm continues. Meanwhile, the terrified chorus is frozen with fear. The storm rises inexorably around them. Their contrapuntal singing, weaving in and out, corriamo, fuggiamo, let us run, let us flee, seems to suggest huge waves breaking on the wharfs. Yes, let us run, let us flee from that pitiless monster. We are already prey. Ah, treacherous fate is more cruel than anything. And indeed, the people flee, and as they do, the storm fades into the distance, and the act ends on a strangely quiet note, disturbingly quiet, as if, poof, it suddenly was gone. We know that monster is not gone yet. We will listen then from the end of the trio. Let this turbulence cease through this sequence of extraordinary events. The coming of the storm, the explosion of the storm, the chorus's acknowledgement of the storm, the coming of the sea creature, Idomeneo's recitative, and then the chorus's final chorus, let us run, let us flee. Absolutely seamless, no breaks in the action, the momentum continuous, the music continuous. This is not, my friends, an opera seria.
al fine. Ma sai che aver pretendi, vittima al fallo mio, una innocente.
Now, quiet and disquieting ending to this act notwithstanding, clearly Neptune has spoken. There will be no escape to Argos. Electra has been stymied, and the beginning of her end is clear. Neptune's monster instead ravages the Cretan countryside until it is destroyed by, guess who? The young, brave Prince Erymante. Now, ultimately, both Erymante and Idomeneo will be pardoned by Neptune, but that's still far in the future of this opera. I will leave the exact events that lead to that pardoning to you, for you to listen to this opera on your own, your hands glued to the translation of the libretto. It is a waste of time to put this music on in the background. Its pleasantries don't even approach the drama you can get and the joy you will receive if you read the translation while you listen. That's the point. And unless you are absolutely conversant in the rather stiff Italian that this opera is written in, I strongly recommend you take that time and you sit down with the libretto. So, it's up to you to figure out why and how Idomeneo and Erymante get out of this fix. Now, back to the second half of Act Two, which is what we've just been dealing with. Mozart has created a seamless, dramatic continuity which seems to laugh in the face of opera seria convention. Where is the predictable pattern of dry recitative followed by da capo arias? Huh? Where is it? Well, it's not there. Instead, we get accompanied recitatives, which is something that Gluck, of course, shows Mozart how to do. We get orchestral transitions from scene to scene, like that march music. We get segues that pivot from the last chord of one set to the first chord of the next. We get a trio, very unusual in opera seria, and a very flexible use of the chorus. Yet this is really not behaving the way an opera seria should. In fact, really what makes Idomeneo a great, perhaps the greatest opera seria, is that because of Mozart's music, it doesn't behave like a dull, predictable opera seria. It's like celebrating a great Cabernet by saying it doesn't taste like dishwater. But certainly Mozart has taken a genre and has elevated it through his own music and his own inspiration. But of course, this is something that Mozart managed to do in almost every genre of music, that is, make it transcend what it was due to his own actions and compositional gift. In 1779, in reference to Italian opera seria, Samuel Johnson wrote this: "The Italian opera is an exotic and irrational entertainment." Well, thanks to Gluck and Mozart, opera was no longer an exotic and irrational entertainment. The Dark Ages, or the Golden Age, however you want to look at it, are now ended. Onwards, then, to the rise of comic opera, opera buffa, and Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro, which will be lectures 13 through 16. But before we pause, I have a soapbox to mount and just a brief discussion on the nature of opera and why we should listen to it. Now look, opera outside of Italy, and sometimes even within Italy, was essentially an aristocratic entertainment. It's something we've talked about today. In our age of PC and proletariat diversity, some of us might ask ourselves, well, is this a good thing? I mean, should we be listening to, celebrating, and reveling in this elitist, aristocratic music? I must share with all of you the following introductory paragraph I received as part of a proposal for a course on world music from a violinist, an earnest violinist that I know. And now I quote: "The classical tradition in Western music, in Eurocentric culture, is a dying, if not dead, tradition. The musical style of the standard repertoire grew out of a relentlessly dominating minority culture known as imperialist Europe. Audiences and players are drawn to this essentially dead tradition as an escape from interactive values which can properly be found in popular and world music cultures. We must reject the dead tissue of our elitist past and embrace the living traditions of the present if we as musicians and audiences are to be relevant to our times." Unquote. This, mes amis, is a bunch of merde, of nonsense, of shoe-soiling doggy-doo, garbage, Montezuma's revenge, a PC guilt trip of the first order. Look, when we marvel at the Parthenon, do we remind ourselves that it is the product of a patriarchal, femophobic, faux-democratic boys' club regime? When we stand dumbstruck before Michelangelo's Pietà, do we ruminate upon the elitist, oppressive, Machiavellian, robber baron, mercantilistic ruling class that commissioned it? When we move and groove to really good, down-and-dirty rock and roll, do we pause to reflect upon the grimy, stinking, tattooed, psychosexual, drug-inspired environment that was its original milieu? When we stand in tears before the subtlety and power of a painting by Rembrandt or Rubens or Vermeer, do we give a rat's butt that this art, quote, grew out of a relentlessly dominating minority culture known as imperialistic Europe, unquote? No, we don't. We couldn't care less. So why do some of us feel the need to flog and flay this marvelous and timeless musical heritage of ours because the circumstances surrounding some of its creation don't live up to our contemporary view of politically correct creational standards? We've got it backwards today. There's nothing wrong with the art. Art created, incidentally, by middle-class and working-class individuals. There's clearly something wrong with some of us. If we as a culture, as a civilization, cannot understand and appreciate and assimilate as our own the crystalline life force and truth in the best art of our past, what does it say about us here today? Is Mozart's extraordinary insight into the human condition irrelevant to us because it was a product of imperialistic Europe? Or are some of us today just culturally and intellectually unworthy of it? Let me put it this way. Let's pretend that in Josephine Vienna, between about 1780 and 1795, there was a PC movement to equalize the musical arts, to celebrate, let's say, beer hall dance music at the expense of more elevated elitist music. Wonderful. Today we would have scads of crummy beer hall dance music. Divorced from its social constituency, this repertoire would simply stand as a monument to drunkenness and bad taste. The great works of Mozart and Haydn and the young Beethoven might have gone unwritten for a simple lack of support and cultural interest. Not only would we today be denied this amazing legacy, but all the composers who've lived since the 1780s and 90s would have lacked the essential models for their own music, thereby altering profoundly, I fear for the much worse, the evolution of Western music. If Mozart and Gluck and Wagner and Puccini and Monteverdi are dead art, I would suggest we've all forgotten how to properly live. In an age of talk shows that celebrate victims, some of us would actually seem to believe that we're the victims of a Eurocentric musical repertoire, iconographic of imperialism and repression, as if there's actually a cultural conspiracy out to get us. Makes you wonder where Oliver Stone stands on this. Of course, what should be important to us always is content, content, and content, and whether that content speaks to us. Now, back to opera. These works, these operas, these investigations through words and music into the hearts and souls of people are as relevant, as classic, as the Iliad, as the Canterbury Tales, as Tom Jones, please, the book, not the singer, Catcher in the Rye, and Gravity's Rainbow. Now, I don't know about you, but their oppressive sins notwithstanding, I'm grateful to the aristocratic and clerical classes of Europe and Asia and Africa and Mesoamerica. Without them, much of the greatest art, music, and architecture would simply never have been created. They had the time, they had the resources, they had the vision, for whatever selfish reasons, to cultivate and finance the work of great artists. I only wish that our financial aristocrats today were one-tenth as interested in our contemporary arts. There would be no crisis in the arts as we know it today, and the pluralism, which is central to our culture, would ensure that our new art would have a chance to become the province of the many, not just the few. Great opera, great art from the past is not elitist entertainment. It is for all of us, each and every one. Off the soapbox, I thank you. Welcome to How to Listen to and Understand Opera. This is Lecture 9, the first of a four-lecture set entitled The Growth of Opera, The Development of Italian Opera Seria, and Mozart's Idomeneo. Please, we would begin with a necessary review of the invention of opera, something discussed at length in the last few lectures, but something that deserves to be talked about a little more. And then we will move on and talk about that most important invention of the aria. But first, just a review of the invention of opera, please. The earliest operas were a synthesis, and that's an important word. You know, we tend to treat the word synthetic today as something bad. You know, if something is synthetic, it's not made out of real stuff. But in terms of music, the word synthesis is an important and a good word because it indicates various different styles and types of music combined where the whole, hopefully, is greater than the parts. And indeed, early opera was a synthesis of many old aspects of music and theater, but with one essentially new aspect. So I would review that synthesis to start with. The earliest operas brought together any number of pre-existing musical genres, compositional techniques, and theatrical aspects. For example, the stage scenery and machinery. And when I say stage machinery, I'm referring to the moving elements one would see on stage as opposed to the stationary scenic elements. In any case, the sometimes spectacular stage scenery and machinery that we see in early opera was inherited from Renaissance theater. So here's an aspect of old. Another older aspect that is synthesized into the new opera are the dance and balletic episodes, which were also inherited from Renaissance theater, ballet, and the masks. I haven't talked about masks yet, but I will when we get to a discussion of French opera. Another old element of Renaissance theater and music adapted to become part of the new operatic experience were the popular songs and ballads of the Renaissance based on simple rhymed poems. The madrigal-style choruses also come to us from the Renaissance, which were used, like the ancient Greek theatric choruses, to comment upon the progress and the drama of the opera in which they were contained. What was new and what made opera work was recitative, and this is very new, invented around the year 1600. The invention of recitative allowed opera to come into existence. Recitative captured what the early opera composers believed was what the ancient Greeks had done, and that is combine the rhythm and articulation of the spoken word, that is, of speech, of oratory. You combine that rhythm with the rise and fall of pitch, as in song. So recitative is, at its basic level, a combination of the spoken articulation of words, that is, we would sing words the way we would speak them, with the same rhythms and the same articulation. Now, there can be no doubt that the composers of early opera were convinced that they had created, in recitative, an infinitely more powerful mode of expression than just speech alone. Combining the elements of scenery, dance, pop-style songs, madrigal, and recitative into a smooth, coherent whole was the great artistic challenge of early opera. Monteverdi's Orfeo of 1607 was the first operatic work to successfully combine all of these parts into a singularity greater than the parts. Now, recitative in Monteverdi, really, recitative in all early opera, was kind of like olive oil, if you'll excuse me. It was used for everything. Recitative was used for action, for narrative, for dialogue, and to describe feelings. It was a kind of all-in-one musical gesture. But here's the important point, and this brings us back to where we finished in our previous lecture. Because of the non-reflective, ever-forward-moving nature of early recitative, and this includes Monteverdi's extraordinary recitative, because of the non-reflective and ever-forward-moving nature of recitation, time can nowhere stop for consideration, reflection, and change. That is such an important statement that I'm going to make it again. Because of the non-reflective, ever-forward-moving nature of recitative, time can nowhere stop for consideration, for reflection, and for change. Recitative, by its nature, occurs in real time, the way a conversation occurs in real time. Now, I've got to illustrate this point because it's a very important point. And let's go back to one of the great recitatives we listen to when studying Monteverdi's Orfeo. This is the Act II, Orpheus's response. This is the moment when Orfeo finally responds, after having been struck dumb, to the information of Eurydice's death. And here's what Orpheus, excuse me, I keep saying Orfeo for one moment and then Orpheus the next. It's the same guy. This is what Orpheus says when he finally finds his tongue, having been informed of the catastrophe of Eurydice's snake bite and subsequent death. He says, "You are dead, my life, and I am breathing. You have left me never to return, and I remain. No, if my verses have any power at all, I will surely go down to the deepest abysses, and, having softened the heart of the King of the Shadows, lead you back with me to see the stars. Or, if impious fate denies me this, I shall remain with you in the company of death. Farewell, earth, farewell, sky and sun, farewell. Now, this is Orpheus's soliloquy-like response to Eurydice's death, his immediate response to her death. I want us to examine the tenses. I mean, what are the tenses, past, present, future, that we hear in this particular bit of soliloquy? You are dead, my life, and I am breathing. All right, pure present tense, here and now. You have left me, never more to return, and I remain. Again, present tense. No, no, if my verses have any power at all, I will surely go down to the deepest abysses, and having softened the heart of the king of the shadows, lead you back with me to see the stars. Future. This is the action that I will do, and this will happen in the future. Or, if impious fate denies me this, I shall remain with you in the company of death. He's anticipating another possible future scenario. Farewell, earth. Farewell, sky and sun. Farewell, back to the present. Goodbye, addio, I'll see ya. If I get back, great, and if I don't, at least I'm with her in Hades. Now, this is action music. There's no reflection here. There's no chance to think about who she was and what her death means to him. This is all action-oriented. You are dead, and I remain. No, if I can do this, I will do this. Otherwise, I will still be here. I am, and I will. That's what we're hearing in this signal moment of contemplation that is this particular recitative. Everything is happening in real time. Please, let's play it. Let's refresh our memory of how it sounds. And please be aware that everything is happening in the present or the future. This is action music happening again in real time. Now, as we talked about when we heard this in a previous lecture, we talked about it as a magnificent example of Monteverdi's art of recitative. Orpheus is impassioned, he's powerful, he's a man of action. This is what has happened, and this is what I will do. But my question to all of us is, how deep are our insights into Orpheus's feelings? I mean, what of Orpheus do we know, having heard this very special and signally important moment in this opera? I mean, do we understand the depth of his grief? Do we get a sense of his memories of his beloved? As an audience, can we share in his anguish? Do we hear anger? Do we hear rage? Do we hear acceptance? Do we hear resignation? What do we hear? Very little of this emotional depth comes through in recitative. Now look, I've got to make a point, and we all understand, that this is infinitely more expressive on a personal level than a madrigal would be. But still, it's not nearly as expressive as an aria would be. Because in Monteverdi, the words equal the music. The words give us all the musical rhythms. The words tell us, because of the emphasis on articulation in recitative, the words create the music. The music is not influencing the words. There is not a musical line here that goes deeper and beyond the mere words to create a whole new emotional place. That concept doesn't exist yet. The concept of aria, where music itself, divorced from words, creates a whole expressive world. That concept doesn't exist yet. So if we can imagine in our mind's eye a big pendulum, and on one side of the pendulum the word words, and on the other side of the pendulum the word music, certainly the pendulum is way up in Monteverdi's, as in any early opera, toward the word words, because the words determine the rhythm and the nature of the expression, because these are pieces based on recitative, which is word. It is left to the subsequent madrigal chorus, if you recall, to ponder Eurydice's tragic death. And we had that public mourning, that moment of ritual grief. But again, it wasn't personal. It wasn't personal. Now let's jump forward and talk about aria and compare this recitative to an aria. And you'll see exactly what I mean when we add that extra musical element to the word. We move forward 155 years to Christoph Willibald Gluck's opera, Orfeo ed Eurydice. So another operatic version of the Orfeo and Eurydice story. All right, let me set the scene for you. We're right near the very beginning of the opera. Eurydice has just been buried. This opera starts out rather more quickly than does Monteverdi's. She's already dead and buried, or being buried, when the opera begins. All right, during the funeral itself, Orpheus has wailed Eurydice's name 3 times. I mean, he is absolutely disconsolate. Eurydice! Eurydice! I mean, real breast-beating stuff. The funeral ends, and Orpheus asks to be left alone. So he's left alone on stage very, very early in the opera. I would remind you in that Monteverdi's Orfeo, we did not see Orpheus alone on the stage until the 5th act. But right away here, in the 1st act, he's alone on the stage, silent, contemplative. And these are the words he sings, supplied by librettist Raniero Calzabigi. Thus I call upon my love at break of day and at its fading. But alas, how vain my sorrow, my heart's idol answers me not. Eurydice, Eurydice, beloved shade, alas, where are you hidden? Your faithful spouse in anguish calls you ceaselessly in vain, begs your return of the gods, and vainly scatters to the winds his tears and his lamentations. Thus I seek my love upon these sad shores where, alas, she died. But to my grief echo alone replies, for she knew love. Eurydice, Eurydice! Oh, our shores know that name, and the woods have learned it of me. And he continues and goes on and on. I've read about half the text for this extraordinary aria that is Orpheus's 1st aria in Gluck's Orfeo ed Eurydice. Joseph Kerman writes, after the chorus has departed, Orpheus begins this 1st aria. Chiamo il mio ben così. The elegy is sung by Orpheus in this opera, not by the chorus, as in Monteverdi's. Orpheus is equal to it. His previous inarticulate wailing is transformed to a tranquility beyond anything that Monteverdi could achieve. Orpheus is shown to pull himself together to a point where grief is viewed and understood, no longer lived, but not shunned either. He transcends his sorrow by controlling it into music, into song, into an aria. The message in this piece is in the music, not in the words. The tranquility that Orpheus feels is in the melody and the harmony, not in the words. The words in music here in Gluck are complementary. The music functions on its own level, providing an emotional underpinning and sensibility beyond just what the words say. And this, my friends, is an aria. Let us please listen, and I would point out that despite the fact that, as we know, Orpheus is a male, you will be hearing a woman sing this. This is because Gluck originally wrote this part for, a male soprano. That's a euphemism. We'll talk more about what it's a euphemism for later in this course. Let's just say that these were the men without beards who were the great and famous singers of the 17th and 18th centuries. So today we will usually hear a woman sing this role, a mezzo-soprano or even a soprano, with the understanding that in Gluck's time this would have been a male soprano. Please listen, and what I want you to think about while you hear this aria is, how is this aria different from the equivalent recitative that we heard in the Monteverdi version just moments ago? Gluck. Is this action music? Is this I am and I will? No, it's not. It's a very different sort of music. We sense that time has stopped. We're living in psychological time right now. We're living within the mind of Orpheus, and we're feeling his feelings and contemplating his ideas and emotions. Why is this happening? Why does it feel that way? Because the music is now so interesting and so full unto itself and complete, that the musical experience now is adding tremendous depth to the words and to the emotions. The musical experience has put the skids on the action, and now we are in stopped time. We're no longer moving forward dramatically. Rather, we're contemplating, with the aid of music, the content of these words, and even more importantly, the feeling behind these words. Joseph Kerman continues, "This art of control was what had been learned. The art of the aria after recitative, the second of the fundamental elements of operatic dramaturgy. Composers could now take a momentary sentiment and project it as realized emotion rather than as an impulsive flash of passion in the manner of Monteverdi." You see, if we take that pendulum again, which was way up towards words in the early operas of the early 1600s, by now in 1760, that pendulum is dead in the middle between words and music. You see, in the Gluck, words and music are on an equal footing. Together they create that, again, back to T.S. Eliot's quote, that indefinite feeling which we can only detect out of the corner of our eye. Now, I would take 1 minute, perhaps two, but I will discipline myself to keep this short, and discuss some of the things that have happened historically and musically between the time of Monteverdi and the time of Gluck, because that would be the era we call the Baroque era that runs from about 1600 with the invention of opera to around 1750 or so. The Baroque was a great era of codification and investigation. It's a very secular age in terms of philosophy and science. It's an era that sees logical thought as being transcendent. The world could be explained and understood if we simply understand the formulas and science behind things. The effect of this philosophical view of the world on music was profound. Music was exposed to the same investigation, the same scientific attitude that every other aspect of the world was exposed to. And as a result, we see the musical language expand hugely during the Baroque, particularly during the 17th century. For example, the art of harmony, what we call the functional harmonic system, really comes into its own in the 1600s. Instrumental music, as a genre of music unto itself, comes into its own in the 1700s. By the time we begin the 1700s, by the time we begin that era of Bach, which would be the first half of the 18th century, instrumental music is at least as popular and at least as common as vocal music, and for this reason. The parts of the musical speech, rhythm, harmony, melody, instrumentation, have become developed enough that instrumental music by itself can create an emotional expressive experience. Please think about this for a second. What would be the most abstract art you can think of? Would it be painting? Would it be sculpture? I mean, what's real abstract art? Might I suggest to you the ultimate abstract art is instrumental music? We don't have words to explain what the music's all about, and we know that music exists in the ether. It's not something we can hold on to. A score, after all, is nothing but a graph. It doesn't tell us what anything sounds like. We have to hear the music in performance. So instrumental music, lacking concrete body and lacking words to explain why something goes up or something goes down, is completely abstract. And until the musical language is substantial enough to create a full experience, abstractness notwithstanding, we won't have an instrumental tradition. Now, I bring all of this up because we've got to understand that opera is evolving even as all of these other aspects of the musical language are evolving also. And by the time we get to Gluck's operas during the classical era, past the Baroque era, we've got a whole musical language available to Gluck that was not available to Monteverdi. The abstract musical language has, by Gluck's time, evolved to a point where it alone can create complex emotional responses and impressions. And so Gluck, like any opera composer, will use pure music, harmony and melody, to create a depth of expression beyond that which the words can. Aria could not be invented until the abstract musical experience was invented. And that happened around 1650, 1660, but after the time of Monteverdi. So aria represents temporary detachment from action, detachment from real time. It is true musical soliloquy. Aria represents opera's psychological time. Now, I would tell you as an aside, but it's an important aside, and we'll get back to Gluck again in a future lecture, that the arias of Gluck were revolutionary in their starkness and in their emotional directness. And I would also tell you that Gluck's operas mark the point where the modern opera house repertoire begins. I'll say that again because that's important. Gluck's operas mark the point where the modern opera house repertoire begins, which makes us wonder, well, I mean, if this opera was from 1760 or so, how about the 160 years worth of operas that preceded Gluck? Well, that's what we must now start talking about. This age of the Baroque opera, sometimes called the Golden Age of Opera, and sometimes called the Dark Age of Opera. It's very paradoxical for reasons we will discuss. The period between Monteverdi and Gluck is, as I said, sometimes called the Golden Age. And let's talk first the good stuff. Why should it be a Golden Age? Well, almost everywhere between about 1640 and 1760, and I'm using 1640 as a beginning of this Golden Dark Age period because this is pretty much when opera became a public rather than a private entertainment around 1640. Almost everywhere between 1640 and 1760, music meant opera. If you can imagine a huge blackboard behind me, and imagine at the bottom corner of that blackboard, off in the bottom right-hand side, the words everything else. And then across the great span of the board, the word opera. That is how music would have been conceived during the Baroque. There was opera, and then there was everything else. Now, we don't think that way today. We know about the music of Handel and Scarlatti and Bach and all these great dead German dudes who wrote all this wonderful music that was not opera. But believe me, at the time, opera was by far the most celebrated music, way outweighing the other genres that existed. Back to the Baroque opera. The number of operas created and produced was stunning. Everything was instantly staged, cheered, plundered for the next seasons, and then thrown away and something else composed in its place. Singing style and stage design saw incredible development during both the 17th and early 18th centuries. Opera, as Vernon Lee demonstrated in his Studies of the 18th Century in Italy, caught the spirit of the Baroque Age better than any other art form. I quote Vernon Lee. The bold blend of music and poetry and scene, the ornate dramatic convention, the pomp and the splendid abandoned theatricality, the fierce singleness of operatic passions, the moving architecture in and out of the ballet, all of this sums up with characteristic extravagance the very aspirations of the Baroque. However, there's another side to this rosy operatic picture, and I would quote Joseph Kerman. The period between Monteverdi and Gluck can also be called the Dark Ages of Opera. In spite of all its extent and fame, and in spite of much musicological research, Baroque opera is very little known today. It is seldom produced, and when it is, the nearly always bizarre productions seem designed to distract the audience from one basic fact, that modern directors find it all of unparalleled dramatic stupidity. Unquote. All right, we've got to talk about Baroque opera. We've got to investigate this golden/dark age of opera. And for ease of study, we'll divide this operatic golden-dark age into two equal chunks of time, 1640 to 1700, and then from 1700 to 1760. Let's begin then with the golden-dark age of opera, phase one. 1640 to 1700. All right, this golden dark age of opera fittingly begins with the opening of the first public opera house in Venice, Italy, in 1637. Let's contemplate this for a moment, and we'll try not to be too rude either to the public or to our modern-day public, but let's contemplate what happens when something becomes increasingly public and increasingly profitable. Yes, opera becomes, first in Venice, and by the way, this first phase of the golden dark age of opera, this 1640 to 1700, this is the Venetian phase. This is when the city of Venice, or at least composers trained in Venice, dominates Italian, and